Welcome to season 4 of the Intersection Hub podcast. This season, we are changing the conversation. We are going to go beyond talking about the challenges the charitable sector faces and start spotlighting charities who are offering us hope, hope for a new way forward in 3 primary areas. That's right. In this season, we are sharing 8 real examples of organizations who are advancing anti-racist work, moving forward with trust-based philanthropy, and taking care of the physical and mental well-being of their staff. So thank you for sharing a little bit of your day with us. Let's get to it. Well, today we are spotlighting an anti-poverty charity in Toronto, Ontario called The Stop, as well as their concrete examples and their experiences implementing community-centered fundraising principles. It's Canadian Thanksgiving, and so it's the perfect time to do this episode because The Stop improves access to healthy food in a way that maintains dignity, builds health and community, and challenges inequality. And The Stop Community Food Center is just that, a community center that brings people together and addresses poverty in a very holistic way. I met Marie-France Rocher and Maria Rio when they were presenting at Toronto AFP Congress in 2022. Marie-France has worked for anti-poverty organizations for the past 7 years. She is currently one of the lead fundraisers at the Stop Community Food Center, where she provides strategic oversight of all fundraising, policy, and communications. Marie-France has also been featured in the Toronto Star, Omni News, and at AFP 2020 Toronto Congress, and she would love to connect with you on LinkedIn, and her link is in the show notes. Maria Rio is a fundraising consultant with Further Together and has 20 plus years of nonprofit experience. She is regularly asked to speak on issues related to fundraising, and her opinion pieces have been featured in national publications. She was a finalist for the National 2022 Charity Village Best Individual Fundraiser Award and has a deep passion for nonprofit work. Maria also is a board member of Living Wage Canada. Now, you can also connect with Maria through her website, Further Together, or through LinkedIn. In today's episode, Maria and Marie-France share concrete actions they took in their organization to implement community-centered fundraising principles. This means challenging the status quo with everything from events, corporate fundraising, major donor stewardship, mission delivery, how they collaborate with other organizations, how they collaborate with donors, and how they meet the community's needs in meaningful ways, treating everybody with the dignity that we all deserve. I just need to do a small piece of housekeeping before we dig in. Marie-France and Maria were extremely generous with me, and I admit some of my clumsy questions around community-centered fundraising. They were so generous that we spent almost an hour and a half together. And since I know that even a 1-hour podcast is a stretch, I've asked my sound engineer, Rob, to tighten this up a little bit, so you may hear some transitions. You may also want to charge your earbuds, because once we get into it, you will not want to stop. So given that we are celebrating Thanksgiving, and we are talking about food security, grab your apron and let this conversation keep you company while you make your pumpkin everything or do your grocery shopping this Canadian Thanksgiving weekend. Let's get into it. Good morning.
Hey.
I am so glad to have you both here. Just so that our listeners can get to know you a little bit more and hear your voice, I'd like to just invite you both to tell us a little bit about who you are or something that would surprise most people about you. Marie-France, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, I think something that would maybe surprise people, a lot of people don't know about me, particularly in a professional context, is that I'm really passionate about feminist film, intersectional feminist film. And so to keep up with my friends, I used to live in England, and so I have very close friends there. So in order to keep up with them, I run a feminist film club every month. And so we choose 2 films that we talk about. And one is trashy and one is classy. So one that's a little more highbrow, maybe a little more challenging, and one that's a little more lowbrow. And the criteria is very loose, but really it's just about watching films that center the experiences of people, women or people who identify as women. And it's been a wonderful way to connect with my friends and have really meaningful, deep conversations. And in my perfect life, I would have a podcast where I talk to my friends and we joke about the films and we have really great conversations and lots of people listen to it and are super enlightened. I think this is the closest I'll get.
No, wait, no, we can start a new podcast. I am dying. Sorry, Maria, but we're talking about this now. But I am dying to know. I mean, first of all, I want to join that club. And second of all, did you see Netflix's Lady Chatterley's Lover? And what'd you think of it? Let's park that. Go watch that. And then let me see what you thought of it. Because
I'm intrigued.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. It of course wasn't as great as the book as far as I was concerned, but now I really want to talk to you about it. So that's a whole new podcast. We're going to talk about The Stop today, but before we do, Maria, would you like to answer the same question? What would people be surprised about you?
I think people would be surprised to know that I love true crime. I am obsessed with watching people talking about true crime on their own podcast while they're doing their makeup. So that's something that's really interesting to me because there's a lot of psychology being analyzed and a lot of the legal systems being analyzed. So it just becomes about storytelling, but also about makeup, but also about, you know, laws and how people get caught. And, you know, it's just really interesting to me, the psychology behind it.
That is fascinating. So thank you for sharing that. I like the BritBox crime dramas. Do you ever watch BritBox? Like the British crime dramas, they know how to do it. Like it's worth a 1 month subscription just to watch some of those. Yeah, Marie France, you know what I'm talking about.
So that's so funny. I just got my partner a subscription for Valentine's Day. So I just installed it last night.
There you go. Yeah. There you go. There's not as much feminist hot stuff as there is stuff for Maria in true crime. So check that out.
But did we surprise you?
Yes, you did. Now my conversation is completely, you know, the things that I wanted to talk about is going to take a little bit of discipline for me to get back into it because both of those things are super interesting. So thank you for sharing that with us. Who would like to introduce us to The Stop and the overall mission of the organization?
Sure, I'm happy to do that. So The Stop Community Food Center is really a community hub embedded in Toronto's West End. And our mission is to improve access to healthy food in a way that maintains dignity, builds health and community, and challenges inequality. And so a community food center is really an organization or a kind of like a local community center that focuses not only on the symptoms of poverty and addressing food insecurity by handing out Pampers or handing out meals, but really looks at the sort of more holistic aspects of poverty and looks at addressing poverty with a number of different programs. So we have emergency food access services, so a food bank and a drop-in meal program. We have community programs that really focus on community building and empowerment. And then we also have urban agriculture programs as well.
Hmm. Fascinating. So instead of handing out food once a week to folks who are unable to buy their groceries, and having to do that every single week, you go upstream and try to tackle the systemic root of hunger.
That's exactly right. And a big part of our model is really acknowledging that people who are experiencing food insecurity are experiencing a whole host of other issues that aren't just going to be addressed through meals or through food hampers, which we know are really, really effective, but really don't address those root causes. Mm-hmm. And so what we say too is that people will walk through our doors looking for a meal or maybe a food hamper and then stay to engage in a number of other programs that we have available. And I think my favorite thing about The Stop is the emphasis on serving people with dignity. So all of our food is really fresh. A lot of it's locally sourced. It's made really with so much care by community chefs. I was just talking to someone an hour ago who was telling me that he was a volunteer in our kitchen and she was toasting spices and making a spice blend for a Somali meal that they made on Monday. And so really it's about making good food accessible to all. Everyone should be able to take part in the good food movement. It shouldn't be reserved for people who have the means to buy organic or buy oat milk or whatever. It's for everyone.
So super important mission. And the focus of season 4 of our podcast is to get to know some of these great organizations. And I know The Stop has a fabulous reputation because even before I met you at AFP Toronto in November of 2022, there were some colleagues who were telling me that I really should chat with The Stop on this podcast. So I'm thrilled to have you both here today. We're not here to talk about food insecurity, though. We're here to talk about this concept of this movement, the philosophy of community-centered fundraising. And one of the things that we want to dive into is what is your practical, real experience implementing community-centered fundraising? But before we do that, I wonder if you could tell us a little bit, for folks who aren't aware of community-centered fundraising, what it is and why it was important for you. Maria, do you want to jump in?
Sure, absolutely. So community-centric fundraising is a newer model of fundraising. It was started about 5 years ago by racialized fundraisers in Seattle, and it's definitely grown out a lot from there. It's a model that focuses on the needs and wants of a community or the people who use your services, instead of what can be kind of a top-down approach, like creating programs because a donor says that aligns with their interest, even though you haven't asked the community if that would work.
Right.
Or really putting the donor in the spot of a hero and like having power over the organization and over the community, and moving away from that towards a more equal playing ground where everyone is valued, regardless of how much they give or if they give time or money, and where everyone has a really meaningful voice in the direction of the organization, the policy work, and the programming done by that cause. It's managed by 10 core principles, which are available on the CCF website, communitycentricfundraising.com/the hub. So they're grounded on 10 principles, which are really umbrella terms, umbrella topics for sub-principles are really good to look at and to start implementing. Not every single principle or every single subtopic will apply to your organization, but there's just so many ways to bring those ideas to life as much as possible. So community-centric fundraising is something that is very fresh to a lot of organizations. Seems a little bit radical, but it's been something that I really loved implementing over the past 2 years.
You know, and thank you for that. And for folks who are listening, please check the show notes because we'll put the link to the website in the show notes. It's communitycentricfundraising.org. Folks can see those principles and then /CCF principles. When you read the principles, and maybe Marie France, you can give us an overview of those principles if you're ready. I've got them up here too. We can chat about them briefly. But when you read them, they actually make a lot of comment. There's a lot of common sense to them. So sometimes when we hear folks talking on social media about community-centered fundraising, the language, I have to say, can get a little inflammatory, and there's an us and them kind of conversation that often happens. But really, if folks are curious about it and you look at the core principles of the CCF movement, they're pretty common sense based. Marie France, do you want to just run through some of those, or am I putting you on the spot?
You're not putting me on the spot at all. No, I have the principles in front of me, so I can either go through each of them. There are 10, or I can kind of summarize them if that would be
helpful. Why don't you summarize them? Because yeah, I really want to get into how you implemented them at The Stop.
Yeah, absolutely. So And I agree with you. I think it's intuitive. I think the approach is really, like Maria said, about grounding equity, social justice, economic justice in the work that you're doing, and really aligning your principles with community-centered work and the work that you're doing. And I think, to me, community-centric fundraising in particular was such a really an appropriate approach for the stop. We're really about centering our community. We're very much about treating our community members with dignity as any organization should. And so really what the principles focus on, and I kind of group them into some four areas, I'd say the first one is dignified storytelling. Mm. You know, really looking at the way you tell the stories of the people who use your services and making sure that is dignified. So I won't talk to you about how we do that at the stop, because in our policies on that, because we'll be able to go into that later.
Okay.
The next one is really focusing on fostering mutual support between nonprofits. I think a lot of donor-centric practices, which are typically more transactional, tend to be quite competitive. And really, community-centric fundraising is trying to address that. And it makes sense. You know, there should be mutual support between nonprofits. We are prioritizing a collective mission, and we are all working towards a better, more just society. So why shouldn't we work together? The next one too is really about building meaningful partnerships with donors. So really not focusing on these sort of transactional approaches to fundraising. It's really about engaging your community of donors and of supporters in the work of social justice and the work that you're doing. And so not looking at ways to reward donors who make certain kinds of donations or stratifying donors based on how much they give. People can give, you know, as much as they can, and really also valuing sort of the different ways that people contribute, whether they're a community member, whether they are someone offering, you know, to tell their story or sort of volunteer for your communications, whether they are someone who volunteers for your organization and gives the gift of time. So really looking at making sure that the way of recognizing donors and stewarding is not transactional. And I think that leads to more lasting, meaningful partnerships. And then finally, I kind of touched on this already, but looking at the collective mission of organizations as a whole and the sector as a whole, and what are we trying to do together, and really trying to support one another, and sort of more than that, I'd say dismantling systemic barriers that lead people to access your services, that perpetuate the very issues that your organization is trying to address. Because what we acknowledge as part of community-centric fundraising, and I think this dialogue has really come to the forefront in the last couple of years, is that charities are not the solution to a just society. We are the band-aid solution, and particularly this fits within food security. Food banks were not designed as the long-term solution to hunger, to poverty. Accessing a food bank is never a dignified experience. It is never really a long-term solution. And so there are so many things that need to happen on an institutional level, income-based interventions, for example, better access to housing, all these things that will lead to a more just society. And we are just here to both address the immediate needs as best we can, but also call out the institutional barriers that really need to be addressed in order to meaningfully create a more just society.
It is a fundamental shift, isn't it? And let's move this beyond the philosophy and into the implementation, if you don't mind. What are some key changes? And I don't know which one of you is best equipped to speak to this. Maria, can you go to bat for some of the key changes that you applied at the stop?
Yeah, definitely. So we worked on implementing four key changes, and we did that in a variety of ways. But the four main ones was around major donor engagement. So how we treat our major donors, how we talk to them, how transparent we are with people, what we talk to them about, not shying away from conversations around power over, wealth hoarding, tax avoidance, all these things that we know contribute to nonprofits being a sustainable band-aid solution instead of a systemic push for change. Mm. We also revisited donor-centric events. So the pandemic gave us a great opportunity to look at how we were doing our events and why, and who was being excluded from those events. So for the stop specifically, you know, we had tickets that were going for as high as $375. Tickets that our community members or service users would not be able to afford. So really revisiting, why are we doing events in this manner? And the other two changes are our role in public policy work. So pushing forward on those systemic solutions. So we surveyed our community members, asked them what would have their most immediate impact on their lives, and then started publicly advocating for that and learning more about what we could do as an organization to support that vision. And the last one, as Mary France touched upon a little bit earlier, is prioritizing the collective mission. So there's a lot of organizations who are doing food security work or, you know, community building support. How can we work collaboratively instead of this is my brand, this is my ED, this is my donor, don't even look at my donor. Instead work towards something that will have the greatest impact on the people that we serve.
Okay, that's beautiful, because it's not about building the Stops brand, it's about ending food insecurity. And that in and of itself is what we should all be striving for, right? So I love how you've sort of parceled these four areas out. Should we tackle them one at a time? Because I really want to get into this major donor recognition piece and really chat about what you, because if I was still a director of fundraising or an executive director, those people are top of mind for me all the time. And I want to keep them engaged and happy with their investment in my organization. But what you're saying is that we need to do that in a new and different way. How have your donors responded to that?
Thank you. Yeah, I as part of my role at Stop, I work on the major guest portfolio. So
okay.
This has been, I've been working on this transition. And I'll just talk a little bit about, firstly, our stewardship strategy. And our process at the moment for thanking donors across portfolios is the same. Mm-hmm. So whenever someone makes a small gift, they or a monthly donation, their first monthly donation, they get a phone call and they get a personalized video. And whenever someone makes a major gift, that's the same as well. And so we've tried to make it consistent across the board in order to really recognize that people are making, you know, as trying to give as much as they can within the bounds of their income level. We also have really strong stewardship strategies for our volunteers that doesn't fall within the development and communications portfolio, but the volunteer program at the Stop is treated as its own program. And so that means that there are really strong ways of recognizing our volunteers and making sure that they understand how much their contributions, the contribution of time, is valued. We also really worked on, you know, reallocating our portfolios. So when we moved away from events, we started to focus on foundations, and those are stewarded in the same way as well. You know, and I say this really though to, I want to recognize that we can't do everything perfectly. So, you know, as you said, Kimberly, with major donors, you of course want to engage them at a higher level. You know, we're not going to go and invite all of our monthly donors in for a tour of the Stop. It's just simply not possible within our capacity. And these are people that are, you know, I've donors in my portfolio who give $150,000 a year. So of course I'm going to be trying to engage them throughout the year to ensure I can ensure and sort of maintain their support year on year. Mm-hmm. But I think the response from our donors has been really, really positive in terms of the community-centric fundraising strategy. I've had donors say to me that they actually felt uncomfortable going to events, that they felt they didn't want to be put on a pedestal. And I think that speaks to both really these sort of, these practices becoming more and more familiar to people who are philanthropists. People are starting to think a lot more critically about philanthropy and the power dynamics there, which I think is fantastic. And I think it also speaks to the Stops donors. And we have a really wonderful community of donors who are pretty forward-thinking and pretty progressive.
So I want to push just a little bit more, but what is the real change that you've had with that major gift portfolio in terms of conversations or enlightening them on your approach? Can you give an example of that for folks who are maybe wanting to learn?
Yeah, so a big part of community-centric fundraising as well is not being afraid to have tough conversations with donors. And to, at times, if you feel that you are not aligned in the way that if they're not aligned in terms of the community-centric fundraising strategy, or they'd say things that are maybe problematic, that you don't tolerate them. And if you need to get to a stage where maybe you need to end a relationship because it's not in the best interest of your community, that you do so. So we, for example, we had a corporate prospect, and they were going to sort of install or build a community garden at their office location. And when we were talking through the plans for this garden, they expressed some concerns about having community members there at that garden in front of their office. And they requested that our staff and that our volunteers really didn't talk about the relationship to the stop. And kind of, for whatever reason, had concerns with the optics of that and it making people uncomfortable. So we, obviously this raised some red flags.
Yeah.
And having a conversation as a team, we decided to end that relationship.
Great.
And
was that hard for your board to do? I know I'm talking over you, but I mean, my head's going, okay, wait a minute. I can just imagine the conversation in the boardroom over this one.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was a smaller project. I wasn't directly involved, but I was aware of what was going on, but it was a smaller project. And so I don't know that the board was necessarily involved, but it was an obvious choice. That was not in the interest of our community.
Right.
So that was an easy, intuitive choice. And we outlined our reasons for doing that.
Yeah.
And I think too, a big part of, I think Maria touched on this in the beginning about recognition and program development. And I think I've seen organizations sort of feel that they, by centering donors, they end up tailoring a lot of their programming and services to donors' interests. So a donor says, oh, I'd really love to see a program that offers entrepreneurship to your community members and gives them entrepreneurship opportunities. Mm-hmm. And I'll give you $150,000 a year for 3 years if you can do this. Mm-hmm. And organizations saying yes, because we're really in an environment of scarcity. And so we feel we need to accept whatever cash we can get in order to keep our organization alive. But chances are, you know, you look at your community and think, actually, entrepreneurship program's not really what they need right now. They actually need help with getting accessing social assistance and navigating those processes. They need food. They need all kinds of other supports. And entrepreneurship is not something that really they're interested in. And then you end up having these programs that are really tailored to donors' interests rather than the needs of the community. And that calls into question, what is a charity for?
Yes. And it's so important, because time and time and time again, as a consultant and a director of fundraising, I can't tell you how many conversations I've had with program staff trying to turn our programs into pretzels so that we can say yes to the donor, as opposed to saying yes to our beneficiaries and bringing the donors inside that tent.
Absolutely. So, and I think what we do at the stop, which I really like, is that we don't list donor names anywhere. So we don't have donor recognition on our website, on any kind of wall. So we've really turned that around at the stop. And the only place we have it is at our Green Barn, but that was from over 15 years ago. So we really do list our volunteers though, which I love. So at the end of our impact report, there's a list of volunteers. And these are the people that actually sort of contribute so much to the fabric of the organization and are so critical to the operation. And so they really are an important part of the work that we do. So we do that, which I absolutely love. And what we also did recently, which was really special, is we named a program after a community member. So we had a community member named Debbie Jenkins, who was a real visionary, who actually recognized a need for an income tax clinic in our community. And so started that up with her own expertise, developed a handbook, trained up volunteers who then worked with community members to file their taxes up to 10 years in arrears. So they retrospectively, so they really, it's a hugely effective program. It returns over $200,000 to the community every year and puts money in their pocket, which is cash is king. And unfortunately, very sadly, Debbie passed away, I think it was last year. And so the tax clinic is now called the Debbie Jenkins Tax Clinic in her honor. We had a really meaningful opening of the Debbie Jenkins Tax Clinic a few months ago.
And what's interesting about that is that you wouldn't think that food insecurity and income tax filing is connected at all, but it is. It is. Yeah,
that's absolutely
practically. I mean, you can't get a job. You can't, you know, so there's so many things about lifting yourself up. And in order to do that, you kind of need to get on top of your taxes. So there's a lot to talk about the major donor piece and stewardship piece, but I encourage listeners to reach out to either of you if they want to talk about that more or to get a copy of your slide deck from AFP. The other piece that you mentioned were the way you reimagined events. And I came into the sector doing a gala, as many of us did. And these are traditionally thought of as a pretty exclusive, highbrow kind of way to raise money. Maria, do you want to jump into this one and share with us the changes that you implemented?
Yeah, absolutely. So when I joined the STOB at the beginning of 2021, it was a little bit difficult because we were thinking, oh no, we can't do events. What does this look like in the future?
COVID. That was the big gift of COVID to the sector, was everybody had to stop doing their shitty events. Not that yours were. I'm sure yours were great. But, you know, okay, there's my bias. Okay.
Yeah. So I did an environmental scan of the organization and was really looking to focus on the most return on investment. So that's how I pitched my board on community-centered fundraising. Like, hey, these events, they work to an extent, but if I had a major gifts fundraiser doing this, or if I spent more money on monthly giving or X, Y, and Z that builds more personal relationships, I'd be able to raise more. So that was one conversation that we had with our board. We also started really looking at the events and who was included and who was not. So they felt very transactional. Mm-hmm. We would see people once a year, they would eat their dinner, and then they would come back to the event next year.
Right.
But when COVID hit, only 20% of those people made a donation, which was wild because some people had been coming to our events for years and years. And it's not that we weren't reaching out, but it is because they were so transactional in nature that people had not built that relationship with us, that partnership and that investment in our community and the issues that we really cared about.
Yeah. And the connection to your mission.
And the connection to our mission. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it was super transactional. Actually, 1 year, one of our events was blown away by the wind. And people were asking
like
for
literally
blown away by the wind because it was an outdoor event. And it was just so stormy and windy that it was blown away. And people asked for a refund. They didn't know it was a charity event. They only were there to get, you know, various vendor local eats. So it didn't really work to build that partnership. Mm. In addition, the events were also, as I mentioned earlier, like super exclusionary to our community members. So many of the community members are on ODSP or OW. They're on some form of social assistance and they spend more than 50% of their income on rent. So how can we ask?
Let's just say that again, because that's another piece, the housing security that we're living through in 2023. Many people are paying over 50% of their income on rent, which is a huge problem. So
yeah,
I just want to let that land for a second.
So we looked at events and the cost per entry. Mm-hmm. And the way that I pitched this to the board was, hey, tickets are $125 to $375. Like when I was experiencing food insecurity or accessing emergency services like this, there was absolutely no way that I would even consider spending $125. I used to eat a whole month for $125. So you're telling me I would spend that in one night? And then what about other barriers like doing my hair or getting my nails done or my makeup or the right outfit? Or do I have to spend money while I'm there? There's so many ways in which a community member or our specific service users would feel uncomfortable in a place like that. So we started having conversations with some of our donors, our major donors. And they started echoing to us, yes, it did feel 1%-y for me to eat a meal at a $300 event when it's not something that the community members can actually enjoy.
Yeah.
So that was something that really made me feel like we were headed in the right direction. Like, who is this for? If the donors feel it's 1%ery and the community members can't come. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, like, you're not attracting your billionaire donors to events because they've been going to galas since they were kids.
Honestly, they're not so go. Tired. Those people are so tired. The best gift we can give them is to let them not have to come.
Yeah. And when you ask donors, like, hey, what was your most like meaningful gift that you've ever done? It's never a sponsorship. It's never, I bought a ticket to this event. It's yeah. always, I ran this, you know, event myself
yeah.
as a birthday fundraiser for my partner or something. Like, it's something where they really know the organization and have a really close yeah. tie. It's not something like a gala.
Something you said earlier, though, also it bears repeating, and that is that when your event stopped, you realized that only 20% of the people who attended were actually supporting the organization on an ongoing basis. So
yeah.
did this shift enable you to increase or to elevate your other revenue streams?
Yeah, absolutely. So we went from a quarter of our revenue raised through events to nothing, but yeah. we were able to maintain our revenue and actually exceed our targets by moving towards more people-based relationship building. So really actually getting to know people, not talking to them only about money. Like, I want to know everything about you. Why do you care about this? Like, what's your legacy? Like, what do you think about, you know, the problematic aspects of philanthropy? How was your last date? Like,
yeah.
where it's an actual relationship and it's a partnership in the work, yeah. like we're aligned in a lot of ways, is really, really great. Because with events, like, you just don't get that kind of partnership and relationship and insight into an organization that you would if you spend your time doing your fundraising a little differently.
One of the other things we'll be talking about more this season on the podcast is the impact that all of these changes will have on staff relationships. And I'm just going to say that I bet staff were better able to spend their time once they were alleviated, is that the right use of that word, from the responsibility yeah. of having to deliver or produce a large event, because they are so time constricting, right?
Absolutely. And I think for the fundraising team, they also felt a sense of relief. Like, you can turn away a problematic donor. We don't yeah. have to rely on that. We will find our people, and our people are finding us. Our people are coming to us talking about, hey, I disbanded my DAF and I'm going to give you $150,000. Mm-hmm. Right. So there's like so many more opportunities to build that deeper engagement. But I don't know why we're not all capitalizing on them.
So just to clarify for folks who are listening who may not be able to understand what you just said, or not to be patronizing, but disbanding the donor advised fund and liquidating some of that money into good causes is one of the things that donors are starting to do as a result of this conversation.
That's correct.
Yeah, great. Great. So again, so much to talk about with events, but we're not going to geek out on that anymore. What's next? What are these, some of the other things that happened as a result of this? You talked about public policy. Should we dive into that? Did you start advocating for food security? Like, did you level up the amount of advocacy?
So the SNAP has been doing advocacy for quite a while. We did the 15 and Fair campaign and some other things. We did a campaign called Do the Math, where we asked people to live on the same rate as a social assistance rate, which is impossible in our city. Like, it is legislated poverty. So how we started our public policy work for the committee was serving as many community members as we could and asking them what their top three public policy priorities were out of a list of 20. So we were able to get 200 responses in three different languages. And the top three public policy priorities were social assistance rates being increased, affordable housing, of course, and free or OHIP paid access to dental care.
Mm-hmm.
So things that people have a lot of barriers to improving their quality of life and the dignity that they can bring into their own life due to poverty. 62% of our community members were spending more than half of their income on housing, and 67% of them are on some form of social assistance. So 67% of people are trying to make $14,000 a year work, or, you know, $24,000 a year work, depending on the social assistance that you're at.
So I want to challenge this a little bit. If I was a board member and I became involved in your organization because I cared about food security, talking about dental care would feel on impulse like mission drift to me.
I really like that about the stop. Like, they have been able to work as an anti-poverty organization instead of a food security organization, because these are all symptoms related to poverty. But I also have personally unkind views towards the term mission drift.
Okay, why? Tell me why.
Because you're just like focusing on the organization, right? Instead of the community. If the community needs dental care, then why are you trying to get them new backpacks? You know, like, it's maybe not related to what they need. Yeah. And like, if you're really here to make that systemic difference, then why is a mission drift to talk about the things that our community members are asking for?
Hey, I love that point. And I guess the important piece of it is to make sure that you know who your community is.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you really have to get to know people.
Yeah, for sure. Marie-France, did you have anything you wanted to add to this? To this conversation around policy?
Yeah, I think echoing Maria, I think the mission drift concern, really, I think mission drift is a concern when you are designing your programs and services around donors, and you're starting to, that's when it becomes a problem.
Yeah.
You know, charities, I think, need to be nimble, need to do their best to respond to the evolving needs of their communities. And if you're not doing that, what's the purpose? And I think Maria's right. You know, we are an anti-poverty organization, and the biggest and most effective way to address poverty is through income-based interventions. So, you know, we there was that report, and I think it was almost kind of a landmark study, I thought, that was conducted by the School of Public Policy at the University of Calgary. And it used data from the Daily Bread Food Bank and looked at the sort of impact of really tied income to food bank usage. So showed how even a $15 increase in the Ontario Disability Support Program, how that would really drastically impact food bank usage on a national level and then in Toronto. And then comparatively, what a $30 increase in rent would, how that would impact food bank usage and how much it would increase. And I would highly recommend that people check it out. There's just a summary online as well, but you might end up diving deep into the report. And it really, for us, was a very useful resource to sort of share, you know, look at, you know, what, why calling for these changes is so important and how that really drastically impacts food bank usage. And I think what's been, I don't want to say positive, but certainly helpful, is that the media was really focusing, particularly in the last year, on food bank usage across Toronto, just because it's been so unmanageable.
Mm-hmm.
What we've also done in public policy, which I think has been very effective, is using op-eds, so opinion pieces in various news outlets that are calling for these changes. And I think that's really helped to elevate our thought leadership as well. So outside of election periods, calling for these bigger changes. And Maria's written one, we co-wrote one together as well. And then my colleague Tanya wrote a fantastic one about what she'd seen in her program, Healthy Beginnings, which is a perinatal program for low-income parents. So those have been very, very effective at really kind of building thought leadership and have actually attracted some donations as well. We've had people respond to them and reach out to us and say, we saw this in this news outlet. We actually had no idea. We had no idea this was going on. We had no idea social assistance rates were so dire. How can we help?
The path towards system change is never easy. So that's just something that needs to be put out there right away. This won't be a walk in the park, especially because all these issues are systemic. So they're baked into the fundraising and nonprofit model. They're baked into the governance model. They're baked into our HR practices. So there's a lot of huge challenges to overcome,
mm-hmm.
but I like to start with the small pieces and move those forward because small pieces can make a really big impact. So for example, removing the waiting period for benefits, making sure that staff feel welcomed right away. It's a small-ish piece that all builds into better community internally and externally with the organization. So if you're getting pushback from a board member, like, are they the right board member for your organization?
Right. Yeah.
Are they reflective of the community? Because if they are, why are they pushing back against what the community is saying they need?
Yeah. Yeah. And that really brings us down to, you know, call them CCF principles or whatever you want, but it comes down to the organization adopting and embracing and implementing, operationalizing core values. And they can be your anchor in every decision you make with every single constituent that you deal with, right? Are we aligned in this moment with our core values as an organization? And if we're not, what shift needs to be made?
I think a lot of organizations pay lip service to their core values.
Yeah, which for sure.
Sad because they believe them, but it's like, okay, so here's how to operationalize it. But as soon as there's, you know, any challenge or any pushback, it just becomes so tedious to continue to push for that change because everybody is burnt out. Everybody's overworked. Mm-hmm. But like, you have to.
It's not just one person. I think it has to be championing it at every level of the organization. And there needs to be consensus and alignment. And I think the pushback against community-centric fundraising in the sector as a whole has been the prioritization and the sort of protection of the status quo.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're looking at how fundraising has been done and you say, okay, well, this worked. Why would we change our strategy?
Yeah.
And, you know, I think people become used to it and become comfortable with it. Mm-hmm. And in changing the status quo, I think we're also really questioning philanthropy as a whole.
Yeah.
And we're questioning the very power dynamics that exist within philanthropy. And I think that is hard for some people to reckon with if they are philanthropists themselves.
Yeah.
Because they have to acknowledge maybe that, you know, as philanthropists, they were participating in a power dynamic. We're kind of questioning the charity sector as a whole. And I think that's something that confronting can be painful for people and really having to reckon with and kind of changing the status quo is hard. So I think at every level there's change and it takes a lot. Mm-hmm. It takes, like I said, at every level of the organization, there needs to be really championing that, that strategy and understanding it.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to say
sure. That
fundraisers have a lot of power.
Absolutely. Yeah.
As people like board members, EDs, program staff, a lot of those categories don't know how to fundraise.
Mm-hmm.
So they look to you as, you know, you're the ATM, like, you know how to do it, you go do it. And that's a really powerful way to actually say, I'm not comfortable with doing this super donor-centric thing. No, I'm not going to accept used mattresses and then thank the donor. No, of course not. So it gives you that opportunity to educate people who might not understand the like ethical and moral implications of this unethical fundraising practice, internally and externally. So it's a really unique position that has a lot of power.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I love that you said that because if you're a director of fundraising, you have relationships with your board, you have relationships with all your donors, you have relationships with the program staff, you have relationships with all of the directors within the organization, you have relationships with the volunteers. So when it comes to the need to be a through thread for this systemic change, the fundraiser is the one in the organization that needs to champion that. And that can be really scary. It's really not for the faint of heart, right? But we'll talk about taking care of staff in another podcast episode. I'm sure there's an organization out there that's done that well. But Marie-France, did you have something to add to that? And then I do want to get on to this
collective mission piece. But to wrap up the policy work, did you have any thoughts? No?
Yeah. I don't. I think it's such a core part of our work. And I've seen organizations, both when I was living in England and then now living in Canada, feeling intimidated out of public policy work. And I think that has a lot to do with laws, very ambiguous laws around advocacy. I actually pitched an op-ed about this, and it was maybe a little granular and a little too technical, so it didn't get published, but it's going to be on the Stops blog. I don't think it's there just yet. Okay. But please check it out if you're interested in learning more about this. And I went down a bit of a rabbit hole doing research for this piece, but really, okay. I think charities are intimidated out of these very ambiguous advocacy laws.
Yeah.
And there also have been charities who have been investigated for being perceived, or who were perceived to have violated these laws. Yeah. They didn't, but they were audited on a very public level.
Yes. Environmental
organizations, exactly. And this was in the wake of like pipeline projects. And so
Big oil played that hand. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so, and so I think charities, I've seen a lot of charities say, you know, we don't want to participate in advocacy because we want to be impartial. We want to, you know, that's not what we're designed to do. Mm. But I think then that limits us from really achieving what we're set out to do. And a big part of what we do is about dismantling systemic barriers and calling for long-term change.
And being a voice for marginalized communities.
Yeah, and in encouraging them, I think more than that, I think a big part of what we do at CCF or as part of that strategy is allowing them to be their own voice too.
Oh, thank you. We have so much to learn. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Elevating the voices of marginalized communities. It's a shift, but it's a really important one to make, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so we'll include the link to that policy paper if it's up on the Stops blog. Hopefully it is, and we can all check that out. But finally, this collaboration over competition piece. How did you approach that?
Yeah, and I think this is a good way to transition the conversation, because I was talking a little bit about philanthropists starting to have important conversations about the origins of their wealth, about the power structures within philanthropy. And I have met some, I say, you know, across the board at the stop, the donors are wonderful and have a really strong understanding of community-centric fundraising, about equitable philanthropy. And they, for the most part, are very hands-off. They don't want to be handheld. They don't want to be put on a pedestal. They don't even want their names published. So it hasn't been a hard sell for our donors, which is great. And I actually have had wonderful conversations with them. And there's one in particular who oversees their family foundation. They play a very active role in managing the foundation, and they supported the stop for a number of years. And this particular person who represented their family foundation was very open and honest about the origins of their family's wealth. And how they accumulated their wealth. They've also done a lot of sort of personal work on understanding community-centric fundraising and equitable philanthropy. Mm-hmm. And so they wrote a piece on our blog, which I can also send you the link to, Kimberly, listeners can check it out. They wrote a beautiful piece discussing it and also talking about what philanthropy and community-centric fundraising means to them from a different perspective, right? From a organization that distributes funds. And they actually made a decision at the end of last year to close the foundation down. So they distributed the remaining funds and they will no longer be operating as a donor advised fund, which was a pretty radical change. And I know that they pushed for that in their family. They were the ones who kind of led the charge on that. And so really we've been able to collaborate with philanthropists and or donors who are on this community-centric fundraising journey themselves, which has been really wonderful. And I think it's been a big part of building partnerships, being really meaningful, deep partnerships, because the donors are not only engaging in the work of your organization, their work extends outside the bounds of the stop and really looks at the sort of broader structures and the broader structures of philanthropy and the charitable sector, and are starting to reckon with it. And it means that they're just engaging on a whole other level with the organization. So it's been wonderful. Mm. Another partnership that we had in sort of a way that we upheld the principle of of community-centric fundraising, which is prioritizing the collective mission and sort of supporting other nonprofits. Mm-hmm. We actually established, I got to work on this project. It was probably one of my favorite things I did at the stop last year. We established a shared fund of $50,000. The intention of this fund was to for us to get donations from two donors, so $25,000 each to make this $50,000 fund. We would retain half, so $25,000, and put it towards our programs and services. And the other half would go to a local grassroots organization. And so we, when establishing this fund, we went to our, looked at our public policy priorities that were established by our community members, which Maria touched on earlier. And one of the top priorities was improved access to housing. And so we then shortlisted a group of organizations doing this work, very small organizations. They were all smaller than the stop. And we brought the options. I think we shortlisted, I want to say 3 to 5 organizations. We brought these organizations to our community members, people who were taking part in our community advocacy program, and they voted on the organization they thought should win. And the winner was the Neighborhood Land Trust. And they're a really wonderful organization based in the West End, doing great work in basically building land trusts and community-owned properties and improving access to affordable housing. They do wonderful work. So they have been a fantastic partner. So we gave them the $25,000 gift through that came from one of the donors. They were absolutely thrilled and really excited. And they've been a great partner of ours. They actually helped us when we did our municipal public policy campaign. They did a lot of support with that. They actually went and spoke to our community members at our community advocacy training and talked to them about what issues were important to them in terms of housing, what changes they wanted to see. And then they again, plugging the blog, you got to check it out. They did a wonderful blog post as well about the work that they do. So they're a fabulous organization. And really it was, to me, just such an interesting project to work on because it was so unheard of that, you know, they said, okay, wait, so you solicited this donation and then you're transferring it to us. And I was really conscious that people are so spam conscious right now. So I was trying to make it not seem shady when I contacted them about it. but it's just been a really wonderful partnership. And so something that we hope we can do in the future.
Well, one of the things that I take away from that is that when you're talking about collective mission, you're not talking about food security agencies, but looking outside of the box at unlikely partnerships. The fact that the stop could partner with a land trust on having collective impact in the community is pretty extraordinary and not something many organizations would consider.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you asked before, Kimberly, about what do we need to push forward community-centric fundraising? And I said all levels, and I think the biggest is donors too, right? Because we have these two donors who are quite progressive, quite forward-thinking, understand community-centric fundraising on a really deep level. And we pitched this project and they ran with it, which was pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So it was a wonderful, really meaningful way to collaborate with those donors. We couldn't have done it without them, right? We couldn't have done it without their buy-in essentially and their trust. So it was really remarkable.
And you know what comes to mind for me as you were both talking about that is that the concept, the community-centered fundraising principles help donors realize their ambitions and their goals in ways that they may not have thought of before either. And so it really is a service to donors to help them see that if they really want to have community impact, they may want to learn more about the communities that they are trying to support. And that's a gift to donors. So in a way, that is donor-centered. We just need to help see that it's not one or the other. It's a broadening of scope, a widening of the circle, a willingness to learn together and do things differently. When you look back at all of the work that you've done, what gives you hope for the future?
I think encountering donors every day who think very much aligned And I think I touched on this before, but I had a donor, I think it was maybe 6 months ago, and she visited the stop and I was showing her something. I can't remember specifically what. And she said, can I speak to you for a minute? I thought, oh gosh, she's upset about something. You know, you're racking your brain thinking, what did she not like something we wrote, or was, did she have a concern about something that I said? And she sits me down and she says, you know, I was reading about community-centric fundraising. I think she'd read one of our op-eds, or Maria's op-eds. And she said, and it really got me thinking about an event I went to years and years ago at the stop. And it was a gourmet dinner. And, you know, we had all this wine, we had this beautiful meal, and I felt so uncomfortable. I never said anything, but I felt really uncomfortable because I felt, why am I sitting here having this meal when this organization is all about bringing everyone together around good food and bringing in particular our community members around good food. She said, it didn't feel right to me. And I didn't know how to sort of verbalize it at the time. And we had a wonderful conversation about community-centric fundraising. And this is a donor, you know, who's been donating for a long time. And I think it's so, it brings me so much hope. And every time I meet a donor, I just feel that things are changing, you know, and I think donors are way more open to it than I think people might be led to believe. Mm-hmm. And so that brings me hope for sure.
Mm, wonderful. Do you have any final thoughts, Maria?
Yeah, I just had two like great examples that came to mind right away. Because I really believe donors are maybe like 5 years ahead of where a lot of nonprofits and a lot of fundraisers are at. Mm-hmm. Like they get it. They really do. And I think we're holding them back. The two examples that came to mind was this one time where I was talking to a donor about, you know, the role of tax evasion in systemic issues, because we're encouraging you to give me your money instead of give it to the government who could provide funding for some of these things. And it becomes less of a, as Boo put it, a hobby for the rich, right? It becomes something that is systematized in the right way. And she said, oh my God, like, you're right. Like, I just did my taxes like 2 weeks ago and I used like every loophole to minimize my tax obligation. And I didn't even know, like, but now that you're explaining it like this, that totally makes sense. Like, I'm going to revisit that.
Mm.
So that was one conversation that I felt just so understood. It's like, oh, you get it. You see the problem. And the other one was for a donor that I tore them around last year, and I'm showing them the organization, all the stuff. I'm talking about community-centric fundraising, pretty high level, because this is the first time that I'm meeting them. And a year later, they came to me to ask me all these questions about how they're running their granting foundation.
Wow.
And questions about community-centric fundraising and like power dynamics and how to get community more involved in these decisions. So that to me, like, she came in and she brought in other people from the foundation board to come and ask us these questions.
Mm.
So that was like really amazing.
Those are the stories we need to keep remembering, right? I love that we're wrapping this up with the point that donors want us to do this. They want, they're in fact ahead of the organizations in the sector on this work. And we have some catching up to do. So thank you so much for sharing your talent and your journey and your concrete examples for folks. I think it's going to be incredibly helpful. And I'm so grateful that you both were willing to come here and share your work with us today. And now I really want to be part of that film club. And I can't wait for Maria, for you to discover BritBox, because I know that you're going to love everything on there.
Nice. Thank you so much, Kim, for sharing your platform and for asking all these like really good questions to us. I think just giving us a chance to kind of like, oh, why did we do it that way? It's amazing. Thank you.
Oh, thank you
so much, Kim, for having us.
Thank you both very much. We'll put all of the links to all of these resources in our show notes for listeners, and we'll continue the conversation.
Woo!
Well, I hope your house is smelling like turkey or walnut loaf by now. I just can't thank Maria and Marie-France enough for their generous contribution to this podcast and to our mutual education. Their approach to this conversation was so thoughtful, so gracious, and so incredibly patient. I've learned so much about how to approach this work, and I hope that you have too. Remember to check out the STOPS blog posts and opinion pieces in the show notes, and to connect with Maria and Marie-France on LinkedIn. Also, remember the challenge for this season to share this episode with your staff and forward this conversation with your team. Make time to talk about what kind of small or big changes you can make to center your community in your operations. We'll be publishing another great episode next week, so be sure to subscribe to the email list at intersectionhub.ca or follow the Intersection Hub podcast wherever you get your podcasts. And finally, let's move forward in deep gratitude for each other and the abundance that is all around us, while being mindful that not everyone walks through this world with the same privileges as you and I do. Let's keep building community together. See you next time.